This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
We're here today with Bratsu Dmitrievic and Osvaldo Romberg. Osvaldo is a senior curator here at Slot Foundation, as well as the curator of the exhibition of Bratsu's work in the galleries. And Osvaldo, we've already now had a series of conversations with Bratsu, in which we've addressed the role of documentation and even, to a certain degree, conceptions of curatorial practice. In a certain sense, both of you have an artistic practice which is comprised of art history and which takes the form of a dialogue with art history. So first I wanted to ask how curators fit into that picture. You already are having a conversation with artistic lineage. And two, I wanted to just for both of you to speak to your relationship to each other as artists. Osvaldo, you said you've been having a conversation with Bratsu for many years before you even met him. I thought you could also maybe speak to that.
Should I first or
whatever? No, please.
I mean, in the case of Bratsu, to create the show of Bratsu is ridiculous because he's the kind of artist like me who, when I do a show in a museum, nobody tells me what to do. In a sense that nobody knows better than me. I'm not trying to be pretentious, but nobody knows the complexity of my work or his work. It's very difficult because, you see, there are so many things which are not explicit immediately in the work, but you put it in a space in a way that will make sense, that most of the time in the museums have shown, the director were enough intelligent or sensitive not to try to mix in the decisions I will do vis-a-vis the rooms. Only one time in Bonn,
thank you,
Dr. Ronte, who is a great friend and also a great curator, very open, told me, please, the last room of the books, I will put this like this. But he never interfered with the situation where I put the work, because I think also it's true in the work of Bratsu. The work of Bratsu is inseparable of the whole. It's a complete work with a philosophy, with an anthropological point of view. And so it's very difficult to create a show of Bratsu and fragment the space. This is what I think about the idea of curating. There are some shows who should be curator, especially if we go after Duchamp's idea that stupid like a painter. But we are not painters, we are artists, and it's a position that Bratsu defended many years ago without even talking about that, but by seeing his oeuvre as a whole. He has paint, he has photography, he has a sculpture. I mean, we belong, and I say we because the conversation goes before we meet each other, to this kind of idea that an artist should be such kind of person that when you look at the world, you have a vision of the world.
Yeah, I would just compliment to this. Just before you came, Osvaldo, there was, like I mentioned, that there are two kinds of artists. Like, one kind of artist is the kind of more, I would, without any kind of value judgment, say, artisanal, in terms of, like, they produce the work and they don't care what is the destiny of the work, the way it's hung, the way it's framed. And then the other kind of artist that we belong, and it was a practice probably established in the second half of 60s, where you would really care the way the work is displayed, the way it's framed, the way it travels, the way it's perceived, and the way it's even sold. And so there are many artists who do even care what is the kind of final destination of the work, and therefore, I mean, some artists even prefer to keep the works until they are sold to the right hands, or if they are destined to museums or private hands or friends or whoever.
Absolutely. So the role of a curator, again, in the case of Bratsu, it's difficult to curate the show of Bratsu because I really have to have respect for his position and the way he will decide what to show. I think that he has enormous responsibility, and you can see that by the writings. Normally, a curator, well, the role of curator have changed a lot. There is curatorial work after postmodernism, which we can talk a lot about the opportunism and the way, with this, the art milieu after postmodernism vis-à-vis the Biennale, what is today Biennale, to defend local artists in any country who doesn't have art for centuries. But I think the role of a curator, as I see it myself, because I'm not a curator, I'm an artist who curates shows and I'm an artist who teach. I never do a show in which I don't have a question that I want to answer to myself. So when there was the case of Nietzsche, which is a friend from Paris, from, I don't know, 60s, from the gallery we were working, I did a show of Nietzsche in the moment that they were cutting the head of this American guy in Iraq. And I thought, when I can see in television such a real thing, blood, cutting a head, and the public can see that, which is the value of the artificial or simulacrum of blood that Nietzsche proposed. So I did the show with that idea, and that was the catalog essay I did. Of course, I get convinced in the end that it is art, though we have the television, and I explain why, the difference between art and terrorism. I think that this is my way of curating shows, because I'm an artist. I guess that professional curators should have other criteria, probably. But I think that it's very difficult to be a curator these days.
But probably with contemporary art, there is nothing to be cured. I mean, to begin with. No, cured. I said cured and then curated.
Yeah, you see.
Because the artists are, I mean, we know that we were not the first to do it. We know also that there were some shows and this practice began probably with the Russian constructivist artists that Malevich curated some exhibitions. And this is a category of artists I always like to refer because they assume a lot more responsibilities than the artists who are kind of closed in their studios and then they don't care for the destiny of the work after it leaves the studio. So I think many artists who were the true visionaries, they had also, apart from writing the kind of text explaining the ideas, that they curated also many shows because somehow they widened their role in society apart from presenting what they think about their own views of the world. They are trying to suggest to the audience to look at certain things which they don't know about. So it's really about different kinds of discoveries.
I agree. I see. Well, you know, this is the dialogue with him. I believe that I will never do a work which I know the answer. And I think that for me, and I guess in some way I identify with you too, all my life, the work which I did after I left Argentina in the late 60s and I became an artist before I was trying to. I think that it's about knowing. It's about a kind of philosophy in which I complete my life, in a way, using my life to know through a specific focus on the activity I'm doing. And though the idea of curating, I cannot see, I refuse the idea of a curator who is only a curator presents some problems because he really have to relate to the artwork of somebody in a subjective way, but also in an objective way, which is a terrible contradiction. Subjective from the point of view that he has a sensibility, a culture, and he has the right to express, like everybody, his own view. But if he expresses too much his own view, not in the text, but in the display of the work, he becomes doing art about art, which is something that happened in the last 20 years, a lot and a lot more and more in the Biennales.
In the last 10 years, especially.
So what is the role of the curator? How come this history of curatorial work, from being a conservator, who was the one who took care that the paintings don't get dirty, to the one who decides what is going to be in the world called art, if we define art as different from beauty, and we define art specifically related to content and to a narrative. And so it's very conflicting to be a curator today, because it has grown from a manual, even a kind of medicine, doctor of curate the collection, to a proposal of ideologies who sometimes I was flying with the curator of a Biennale in which I participate, and he was sitting next to me. In the meantime, we were in the airplane, the guy began to open a text of Clifford. And then I read Clifford. And then I go to the Biennale, I see the catalog, and what he did was to translate the idea of Clifford on his text in the catalog, but it is not that he invented it, because Clement Greenberg invented Theoria. We can like it or not, but Clement Greenberg have a clear idea, whatever it was wrong or not, and he project this idea. The idea can be true or not, it's not important, but this idea has a kind of, I would say, program or a kind of system in which things happen. The problem today is that I don't see the curators projecting an idea, an utopia, a kind of paradigm, who, true or not, create the possibility to develop works. And this is part of the crisis who comes. First with the postmodernism, because when you see the text of Donald Judd, you can agree or not, or Sol de Witt, but these people, you see the text, and you see they create whatever is true or not, whether we are tired or not of this kind of minimalism, I'm not, but whatever. You see that the works who illustrate this paradigm are in the world today and influencing other artists. The question is, what is today the paradigm that these curators propose? And this is a question who still not answered.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'll just give one example from my personal practice, one early work, which is not shown here. It is the title of its work. It's a painting by Krešimir Klika, and it consists of me placing the milk on the street, and then car passes by, smashes this milk cartoon, creates the splash, and then I was waiting like 100 yards away, stopped the driver, and I would ask him to sign this work or this creation, and many of these splashes remained unsigned. But these splashes that were signed, I would name the painting of so-and-so, of the man who signed it and who accepted this to be an artwork. So in a way, it is very metaphoric of what you just said. I mean, like a curator, in a way, is the person who accepts or acknowledges that an artwork is existing. And we were talking earlier about this kind of voids in every century where apparently nothing is happening, and nothing is happening simply because there is no other person to sign it. And today, I think this balance between the somebody who is proposing a certain model and the other person who is not only the recipient but somebody who is kind of having kind of affirmative attitude is kind of lacking, or that new models which we know were not kind of enriched by other models which are probably suspended somewhere in time.
The other practice, which I know what I'm going to say is not politically correct, but I am the kind of guy who do all these things all the time. There's a big dilemma also, because in the last 10 years with the local biennales, local I mean by countries in which you don't expect, I don't know, I think it is very difficult, because it's possible to educate people to see art, absolutely. I think it's, I mean, not everybody will have the sensibility, because not everybody likes to play golf, and not everybody can, but it's possible to interest people in sport, if I want to generalize the idea of art. What I think is impossible, and I want to talk about, I'm from Argentina, and I know Bolivia, and I know Peru, I have been teaching all over Latin America. It's very difficult to use a horse to go from New York to California as a transport. It's possible to use it as a sport, a symbolic protest against Bush. I mean, it's possible to do that. But you have to give a new meaning to the idea of the horse. And going in the horse for 2 months to California, and then you're putting yourself against Iraq or whatever. That makes sense, has a function. But it's very difficult unless you go to a country in which you cannot use a jeep or a car. Then the function of the horse becomes art again. And one of the things which is my dilemma when I see all these curators trying to do shows in, I will say something utopic because I just come from a Biennale, but suppose I want to do a show in Libya. And I invite the more sophisticated curators of modern art from New York, from the Museum of Modern Art, from the Guggenheim, to do a show in Libya. This is a farce. This is absolutely nonsense because it's not possible to. We know very well that doesn't exist art without a public. Art addresses somebody. Art addresses a sophisticated or not sophisticated public. Pavarotti cannot sing in the middle of the Pampas, but can sing in Buenos Aires Teatro Colón. So all this dilemma of the who see the painting or who see the art, how he is prepared, beauty doesn't exist. Beauty is the one who look at something, who can. All this problem have been disregarded lately. So we have the Biennale of this, the Biennale of soon is going to be a Biennale, as I say, in Libya, and everybody will run because they invite them to have good, you know, drinks, and they pay you the ticket. And when is going to stop of this simulacro parody of multiculturalism in that way?
So what does the casual passerby mean to you?
No, that is a different thing.
Okay, I understand. But
because the work of Braccio is not about that. The work of Braccio is, of course, in a way, is very Duchampian in the sense that. And also his voice before voice, because in a sense he's putting together the concept that art is contextual, that everything can be art, depends where you put it. But he does it using people from the street, not using objects. And I think this is an enormous, I refuse the idea that he's a conceptual artist. He's also conceptual because every great artist is conceptual. His work is, if I will be him, I never talked to him about that, I would be proud to show in the Museum of Natural Science in New York, if they offer me the Museum of Modern Art
and
the Museum of Natural History, I will prefer to show between the animals because I believe we are animals and art is a creation of these gorillas that we are. So I think the work of Braccio, and that's what I say we meet before we meet really, is because I believe in this awareness that the work of Braccio and some other few artists have in the last part of the 20th century to make us feel the intense idea of the melody of the universe, of the idea of something we cannot explain to religion. And so we have it in the work of art. In that sense, I feel totally identified with his work because I try from a different point of view the same. I see the work of Opalka in a very more strict, narrow image, talks about this idea of metaphysical time. There are artists which we can identify perfectly with this line in which is this awareness of the universe, of the complexity of something, the enigma of the universe, which is in the work of Braccio, which is in the work of some other artists, sometimes Kunelis too, and some people. Now, how can you curate a show like this? By the title, by the content, by the artist. A group show is a failure, generally, because it's very difficult to ask for somebody to come and put his attention and have a relation with the work of art when two jars later or 10 feet later, he confronts somebody else with another mentality, with another code. So in general, it's very conflictive unless it's something who ties. It's very curatorial work of group shows is more difficult than anything else.
But so what is it in, for instance, Laurent Hagee, a curator that both of you work with, that diverges from that?
Well, you know, Laurent Hagee, Ronte, Sheps, and we can go on, Salmona.
Yes.
By chance, all these people curate the same. When I went to Laurent Hagee, he pulled out, Braccio. Well, you came after me, I think, in Vienna. But anyway, no, I came after me, I mean that the order of the show. Bertrand Lavier. I mean, you pick up the selection of this curator, you see, and then you see the same artist 5 years later in the other museum with another curator, and when you put all these curators together, there is a sensibility. And the sensibility of these curators, which I like, of course, is Clavens, is the sensibility of this metaphysical idea of art as a religion, almost. A religion which is not, you know, with the dogma of going to the church or to the synagogue or to the mosque, but a religion of this awareness of metaphysics that is in the work of the people that this
I wrote a short story. I write usually my stories in the airplane when I can't do anything else. When I can't hit a golf ball or paint, then I kind of write. So there is a story about one guy who is kind of like going from one end of Africa to another, enjoying the landscape, and then suddenly he is confronted with the what do you call the group of lions? Hurdle? No.
Herd of lions.
And then he's running, and then suddenly he realized that he is not fast enough to escape to the lions. And then the last thing he can do, he starts singing. And so all the lions get quiet, sit, and watch him singing. And then, like 2 minutes later, there is one lion who jumps and eats the man. And all other lions, they ask, why did you do this? And he says, And he was deaf. So really, this is what happens. Like, suddenly there is like a whole generation of, I mean, like, this man is obviously a metaphor for one, but also for many artists. And there is enough that there is just suddenly one deaf lion, and this is a kind of incarnation of the power of the negative force in the society, which stops certain events happening. So I'm referring constantly to this kind of voids in every century and the happy moments when kind of good curators, good artists, good art writers, good collectors, good museum directors are existing in the same space and time, and then kind of the things are on the surface, and then if not, then we have the cases as I mentioned previously.
I'll ask one last question, and then I'll let everybody else jump in as well. It's a somewhat of a stupid question, but just for the sake of conversation.
No, there are only stupid answers. There are no stupid questions. Yeah, okay.
You're a good teacher. Why is the show not chronologically arranged? If this is a retrospective, why is it not by chronology that it takes that?
Because I don't believe in linear narrative. I have one a sentence in the Tractatus Post Historicus book that the moments from million years ago and the moments from the million years to come are meeting in the same post-historical second. So, and also I have some equations like saying that 1,000 years equals to 1 second of post-historic time, meaning that post-historic moment is much richer than all this kind of millennium of official history. And in that way, I mean, if I would be respecting the chronology, which is very artificial way of observing the things, then I would be blind to many phenomena which have happened, and then somehow the official chronology would not work. In Florence, in the early 16th century, as early as 1520, there was an artist who would do the cubist work. His name was Bracelli. And then the official cubism comes like in 1904. And then in the Tractatus book, I'm also referring that the natural time for cubism to appear is in the times of Magellan or in the times of Columbus, where the kind of all these European sailors were confronted with African sculpture for the first time. And then obviously if there was a time to be impressed with the African sculpture which inspired Picasso and Braque, it was the time of 16th century and not the time of early 20th century. So I don't kind of I mean, these are just the very concrete examples why I don't respect this chronology which is imposed.
At the same time, the casual passerby work that's on display in the front gallery, it was very important to you that, you know, the certificate list 1969 and 2007.
Right.
It's not a contradiction.
It's the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because for somebody, it's now like 69, for somebody it's 2007. And I remember my parents had, actually, the doctor who gave the birth to my mother, I remember they were art lovers, but they would, like, when they would meet every 6 months, he would say to my father, I do accept that Renoir is a good artist. And then 6 months later, he would say, you were right about Cézanne, but I don't like Picasso. And then next year, he would say, Picasso is a great artist, but Malevich is a real shit. And then, I mean,
yeah.
So, I mean, just for the fact that I was a kind of radical young man with long hair, I was just interested in the art of the 20th century. But when I reached certain maturity, I understood certain things which I saw as a little boy with my parents being in Louvre or being in different museums. And there is just one general idea of art, and that is for me this kind of cognition and beauty. And I say there is no beauty without intellectual provocation. So it contains many things at the same time, and the time is only one, and it is present, whatever that means.
You know, apropos the work of Braccio, but also the work of... I believe that the life of an artist, like the life of everybody, is a salami. If you take a salami, here is zero life, and then when he dies, zero life again. In the meantime, it's like this, right? There's a center, and then become the crisp with being old. For me, the work of an artist is like a salami because you can begin to cut slices. And whenever you will cut a slice, the content will be the same. Grease, meat, and sometimes pilpel, whatever you call it.
Pepper,
and whatever. The salami is Milano, or the salami is Argentina. And so I refuse the idea of shows. As we do shows because we have not other options. But I will look, if I will have the chance, I will do all the time retrospectives. I think he's right, yeah. Because it's a salami. And I don't refuse. I mean, in order to understand the salami completely, you have to put in display probably, take it heuristically, you know, like, not heuristically, it's a worry sign for me. You know, you have to take one by one the slices and put it on the table and then see all together this salami, which is mixes of life, you understand what I'm saying? And this is the metaphor I can use for the life of my life. The salami is not finished, I hope, for a long time, but I'm at least in the middle of the salami. So when I look at my own work, and in retrospect, like I did in Bonn or I did in other museums, I look at the first piece of salami and I go, I am this guy, this picture is me when I was that time, it's not me today. But I recognize myself there because it involucrates
a lot of... It's the same content.
Right. The material is the same. And I see that Neruda said that, or Saint John Peirce, I don't remember which was the poet who said, in fact, every poet has only four or five words, and he turns it around. Mm. But I totally agree with the sayings of Braccio, because I really believe that every artist an artist can be an extravagant who found a code to express his extravaganza in the end. Mm. And extravaganza, in fact, is the reaction you have as a human being vis a craziness of the society, the world, the reality, your wife, your children who make you crazy. And all these together create this extravaganza, this neurosis, thank God, that we have, which can be converted if we are enough healthy not to be a banker or a lawyer or a dentist, and we can become artists, which is a healthy profession in the world. No, I really believe that. And because it's really being in the world, artists, and I'm not talking about painters or who we are, also right. Poets, also writers, these people are in the world. They're commenting in the world, in the existence, in the mysteries of life. And this is the way, I'm sorry, I see art. If I have to take art, if I will know that because all my children are artists, and I have one son who is going to show soon, 24 years old. If I will know what art will become now, when I was 18 years old, when I was 11 years old and I used to paint and believe I'm going to be an artist, I will not be an artist. Probably. I will be probably an archaeologist or maybe an astronaut, something more excitant.
An anthropologist.
Yes, Max Excitant, because for me to be an artist, I remember teaching 30, 40 years at least. The questions of my students after they finish the academy, where can I go to learn a little? The question today, before they finish, can you give me, where can I go? Which gallery should I see in New York? This is something terrible. Because they see art as a product, not as a creation.
No, we were a happy generation in terms that, like, when we gathered around dinner tables, discussion would always be of the theoretical nature. And I remember when it suddenly somehow stopped, like in the mid-80s, we met some artists who are not far from our age, but artistically, I mean, as artistic generation, they were after us. And then discussions were basically, can you introduce me to your dealer? I'll introduce you to my dealer. Can you present me to your collector? I'll present. And, well, this was natural that artists would do for each other. But then, I mean, the kind of more abstract discussions were more welcomed before than in the 80s, I would say. But just as a little advice to the future curators, never trust an artist. I wrote a story. Just trust your own judgments. I mean, I wrote a story which is located in Paris, and it's happening like in the 30s, and there are two people coming from Provence to Paris, and one is a cheesemaker and the other one is the artist. And the artist becomes successful and the other one has a little cheese shop, and he's a fromager and he sells these different cheeses and so on. And then one day in the week he comes to meet his companion from the same village, and they open a bottle of wine, and the other one brings his cheeses, and then the cheesemaker spots that there is a kind of void in the wall, that there was one painting missing, and he asks, where is this painting gone? And then suddenly the bell rings, and there is a collector and who bought that painting which was missing, and he takes another painting, and then the artist says, I would very much like to come to see where my paintings are hanging. And the cheesemaker from that day on decides, and he tries to make the appointments with his clients to observe them when they eat the cheese which they bought in his shop. And sometimes the cheesemaker is very worried because he knows that sometimes some people wake up at night, open the fridge and eat, and he's not there to observe them. And then there are a few clients who accept, and then he comes in their place and he looks at them when they eat the cheese, and he's very happy, kind of accomplished his full mission. And so the years go by, and then 50 years later, he comes again to his friend's studio, and he spots that there is one painting missing, and then he says, well, did you go to see this time how this painting is hanging at this collector's studio, collector's apartment? And he said, to be quite frank with you, I never did it. And so he realized that he based all his life on an artist's lie. So that's the end of my story. what my idea about art is, and I don't know would other artists or would Oswaldo would agree with this, but somehow my idea was that the role of an artist is to build some kind of or to insert elements of active skepticism into a spectator. Because if this active skepticism is gone, this world is dead. That's at least what I think. Because, for instance, I think we all know the theories about what distinguishes the man from an animal is that the animal don't use the tool, and that implementation of tool is the act that distinguishes the man from other living creatures. And if there was not this man who spotted the kind of stone which was shaped like a hammer, then probably the world would not exist in its present form today. And I even always say that this first kind of act of spotting the stone that looks like a hammer was also a creation of the ready-made. And this all wouldn't be possible without this sharp kind of perceptive kind of capacity of an individual which is able to solve this problem when it's needed. And if we lose this capacity, then I think that's the death of any society.
Can you speak to, as Osvaldo was, the difficulties of kind of going into the arts today, as well as the ways in which your work is so kind of emergent from a particular socioeconomic period in the 60s and 70s?
Well, I was saying, I mean, I would say that our generation was lucky in a way that it was a kind of like parallel to what we did. There was a kind of economic boom, and it manifests itself through kind of good music. I mean, starting with Beatles, Stones, and other bands. But the thing is that, for instance, maybe now I recall this fact that the students in Oxford, I mean, if that was your kind of question, before they were able to keep their lodgings during summertime, and now they have to move the day after the last exam and to move in back because their rooms are rented in between the kind of last exam and the beginning of the school year. So and for instance, I don't know, when I started traveling up and down the Europe, the petrol was so cheap that we were not worried if somebody would say there is an opening, like when we were driving from for instance, London to Zagreb or Belgrade or wherever, we would go through Düsseldorf and then see Richter, Beuys, Palermo, Imic, Noble, many other artists, and somebody would say there is a fantastic opening in Turin. We would just go there, and then, for instance, Sperone would say, why don't you stay 4 days longer? You can stay there, and there would be another opening like 30 kilometers somewhere. And even I remember there were football matches played, the Arte Povera versus Conceptual Art, where Sperone would play with the Ars, with the Hubler and, I don't know, John Joseph Kossuth, and versus Anselmo, Pennone, Zorio, Mario Merz, I don't know. It all sounds crazy, but it was just so natural.
Absolutely, you have a story about that. I was one day coming to Munich, and there was a party in my dear house. Well, what are we doing? He said, you know what? Let's get drunk. We go, no, I don't want to get drunk. He said, why we don't go to the Biennale of Venice? We go, how will we go to the Biennale of Venice? We go into the car. I seen at midnight, 6 o'clock we were in Venice, to see the Biennale, and then we come back. And I remember, as you say before, there was an opening in Palais Beaux-Arts in Belgium, in Brussels, we were in Paris. We go driving and come back. That was typical of that time. We didn't have Rolls-Royce, we didn't have Volkswagen.
Yeah, I had the Volkswagen Beetle.
Yeah, the same thing. So I think that something has changed a lot. And you know, the introduction of money into their work.
But I can tell you, I mean, like, for instance, my show in Mönchengladbach, which was the place for one or two generation of artists, happened to the broken, thanks to the broken windscreen wipers. And I knew that the boys and Jasper Jones had the show there, but I wouldn't even dare to go there and knock on this curator's door. And I didn't know even how big is this city. And I remember we were driving through Germany through the snowstorm, and the Volkswagen Beetle had this little triangular windows on each door, and I had a piece of string rope which I tightened around a windshield, and it was a kind of a loop. And Nana and I were probably singing and kind of doing this job and this windscreen. And then we stopped to the city of Mönchengladbach. And then this guy said, this was happening like at 11 in the morning. He said, come at 5 o'clock to pick up the car. So we went to museum, and then we went outside. We had a coffee. Then we went to the museum again because it was raining. And then I decided to go to the office and to ask for this curator, Johannes Kladers.
Marvelous.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, and then his secretary wouldn't say he's busy and so on, and then he said, she said, he's got 3 minutes to see you, and he received us, and we stayed 7 hours. He dropped all his paperwork, and he said, this is my home number, and. You know, the paradox of today is I saw the other day in New York, I think he was a bum, and he was in his cell. And if somebody would ask him, if he would call somebody probably who doesn't know who he is, if they would say, what is your home number, he would say, I have no home and I have no home number. And in those days, if somebody gave you like a home number, it was a really extremely friendly gesture. Yeah.
Clarence did the movie for me in my Venecia retrospective in the Biennale. And one day he told me, "But you just know me. What I sing is what I say is art is art." He told me. He was very. But Mushula was a fantastic place. But I think that what happened to Braccio, it happened to me a lot, I guess. When I go to a museum director and he's an art historian, I get a show in 5 minutes. But if he's one of these guys who's a poet, and who...
But not only the poet, you know, the trouble of today's world is that we live in the time of consensus. Nobody makes anything just because one person thinks it's good. They make hundreds of phone calls. That's why we have mobile phones. You can get your friend who is on the golf course. You can get another one who is on the bike. And then they say, what do you think of this artist? Shall we do it? Shall we not do it? And that's not the way the art scene was created in the past centuries. I mean, you have a kind of like a misunderstanding between creative individual and the society, but not as big as today. Like, for instance... if somebody like Leonardo, I mean, when he reached some point of misunderstanding with Duke of Milan, he went to a couple of other castles and then finally settled in France with the French king. And that's my driver who splashed the milk cartoon and signs. So we had one-to-one relationship, and I think that's the way how it should be, because after all, I don't believe also in the art groups. I believe of the fraternity, of the similarity, of the spirits that can create a kind of movement, or that there is a mutual respect between the artists, but I don't believe in collective creating. You can't do this, and therefore you cannot do collective curating.
I agree totally. I don't understand. I know, I'm another generation. I can understand. I can create a work with Braccio, with somebody, with make a project, but my work is about something who only I can create.
Exactly.
It absolutely belongs to me. Apropos what you asked Braccio before, this, I don't know if he will agree. Talking to him, I understand that his work is so related to his life and the way he was living under communism, too. And my work, because one day Jan Hood came to my house and said, you are an intellectual because your work should be autobiographic, Jan Hood.
But I believe, honestly, that maybe it is autobiographic.
Yes, so I answer him the following.
Yes.
Your father was a collector, right? Yes. You were to the Louvre when you were 6 years with your father and saw all the art. The only thing I saw when I was 11 and I became sure I was going to be a painter was to copy a fake Goya and a fake Greco who was in Buenos Aires. And the first thing I did when I was 17 and I went to Marseille was to take a train to see the Louvre and to see Vermeer.
Yes.
So my admiration for what is a masterpiece, which is the answer I don't found yet after 40 years of working in the same thing, is different from his answer about what is, in a communist regime, the importance of somebody. You know, if you look at the work, I don't want to compare, but Milan Kundera.
Yes.
If you read the good books of Milan Kundera, you see this absolute admiration that he has for the freedom of each individual and who is who. I mean, the respect for the intimate desire of each person. I see that the work of Braccio is very related to this idea. I don't know if he's aware of that or not.
No, but I mean, there is it touches definitely because... Probably what accelerated making me passersby because I was unhappy that dictator figure is put on the most prominent square.
Absolutely.
In the city. So
yeah.
I wanted to kind of... of course, and the best formula to criticize this was to put anonymous person chosen by chance on the same spot with the portrait... of the same size.
That's what I say when
right.
It's autobiographic. You know,
yeah, of course it is. Of course, I mean, there is a lot more to it. But then I would say that probably the triptychs installation, when I started incorporated master paintings in the mid-70s into my own work, comes also that I always say that trouble with men is, I mean, a man is a very schizophrenic being. It's neither culture or nature. So when you are hungry, you become more nature. When you're not hungry, you become more culture kind of thing. So we are kind of constantly floating between two extreme poles. And therefore, certain systems will project certain values as... For instance, there was personality cult in the communist countries to which I opposed, and I was happy that I was able to do this with almost no consequences. I was not accepted to artist union, and I left the country very quickly and so on. But having in mind that man is more or less everywhere the same, then this projection to kind of this fictitious fragments of human existence or to fictitious choices, whether is it the cult of personality or cult of value, which might project to the fictitious value of the piece of canvas, stretcher, and the coat of paint, it's another manifestation of that same kind of... unresolved problem that exists in the human nature. And for me, I'm well for it that Van Gogh costs 100 millions. 200, I mean, it's unique. He cut even his ear, which makes him more unique from other artists. But I love his work. For instance, I did an installation recently in Musée d'Orsay with his self-portrait, but I took this not because it costs 100 millions, because it tells me about whole existence of one man, and existence of one man should be of primary importance to the society, of any man. And that's where I kind of picked on the cult of the value.
But that's the way with this autobiography. You grow in a country in which, you see, Let's make the antipo. I was in the country who was totally capitalist, like Argentina, and everybody who was in there dreamed to be, one day would be communist. So I only feel guilty, you see, I feel guilty because when I was young, I was painting modernism, and all the communist artists who dominate the ambiance, yes, the power, said to me, hey, you have nothing to do with the people. You paint for an elite. And then when I win the National Award, the Communist Party in Russia invite me to Russia because they made me a big part in the Russian embassy because they want to keep intellectuals too. So for me, the idea of feeling guilty because I'm not Pavarotti and I cannot sing for everybody was the opposite for you.
But there is always lion waiting for you.
No, but you understand the antipode situation, why we do what we do, that you do this kind of individualistic signaling, this is unique and it's important like this, and I was trying to do the opposite. I mean, it's interesting how the life of two people coming from different points of the planet with different regimes cross in a way with the same sensibility.
No, but art... I think politicians are chosen through consensus and artists is chosen by God. And that's what I really think, because good artists are like good conductors. They are first to tell you something which is happening there and here. You know, so I think in a way that... we have always to relate, to understand really the nature of art, we have to relate to the cave time. And there were people who were legitimately sleeping around the fire, and there were people who were legitimately awake because they couldn't sleep, they thought about their existential problems and how they relate to the environment. And then this guy who takes a piece of coal where the fire already kind of was gone, and then he takes this piece of coal and he draws this on the wall of the cave in order to explain the world first to himself and then to the others. And therefore, I think regimes could facilitate presentation of art, but this kind of creative nature could be suppressed for some time in some situations and some regimes, but this existential need to explain the kind of situation in which you are cannot be kind of withdrawn under any circumstances. I mean, let's take the extreme examples like Auschwitz. There were people who were writing or composing or kind of rehearsing the things in their head, and then if they survived, they would put this on the piece of paper. And I'm kind of a very strong believer in this kind of individuals who are able to resist to kind of any kind of situation and are creating the things because they have this need, and then they give this, they offer it to the others, and whoever can kind of follow that model of thinking, or they just join. I mean, and that's the way how I perceive the things.